That's a bloody work of art.
Why, thank you, said Sabitha, giving a mock bow to the room. I have to admit, I only got two of them off belts. Third one was lying around in a watch station. I figured I had no business turning down that sort of temptation.
But why didn't you tell us what you were doing? Said Locke. Tracing the watch on your own?
Have you always told everyone else what you're up to? Said Sabitha.
But you could have used some top eyes or a distraction just in case, said Locke.
Well, you were busy. I saw you and Jean baking your little cake.
You're showing off, said Carlo, hoping to make an impression.
You think there'll be a choosing, said Galdo slyly.
Chains said there's a chance every year, said Sabitha. Might as well stand out. Haven't you two ever thought about it?
The full priesthood?
Carlo stuck out his tongue.
Not our style. Don't get us wrong, we love the Crooked Warden, but the two of us...
Just because we like to drink doesn't mean we want to run the tavern, finished Carlo.
What about you, Jean? Said Sabitha.
Interesting question. Jean took his optics off and wiped them against the tunic sleeve as he spoke. I'd be surprised if the Crooked Warden wanted someone like me as a divine. My parents took oath to Gandalo. I like to think I'm welcome where the gods have put me, but I don't believe I'm meant for anything like a priesthood.
And you, Locke? Sabitha asked quietly.
I guess I haven't really thought about it. That was a lie. Locke had always been fascinated by the hints Chains dropped about the secretive structure of the Crooked Warden's priesthood, but he wasn't sure what Sabitha wanted to hear from him.
I take it you have?
I have.
There was that smile of hers, a smile that was like the sun coming out from behind a cloud.
I want it. I want to know what Chains smirks about all the time. And I want to win it. I want to be the best.
She was interrupted by an echoing clang from the entrance tunnel. That could only be Chains returning to the burrow from the various preparations the night would require. He rounded the corner and smiled when he saw them all gathered.
Good, good, he muttered. Sansas, the wine is being carried in by some people who'll be less busy than yourselves. Everyone else, I trust you have your offerings?
He looked pleased at the nods he received. Locke caught the twinkle of unusual excitement in his eyes, despite the dark circles beneath them.
Excellent. Then let's have some dinner before we leave.
Will we need to dress up or bathe for this? Asked Sabitha.
Oh, no, my dear, no. Ours is a pragmatic sort of temple. Besides, it's no use in trying to prettify yourselves, since you're going to have sacks thrown over your heads. Try to act surprised. That's the only little secret I'll be giving away in advance.
4. A hush ran through the assembled thieves as several men and women, using a collapsible wooden frame, hung curtains over the door the postulants had been carried through. Other than a few vents in the ceiling, that door was the only entrance to the room Locke could see. Guards took up positions by the curtains, serious bruisers in long leather coats, with cudgels and axes ready. Chains had explained that their purpose was to ensure the privacy of the ritual. Other guards would be out there somewhere, an entire network, lurking along every route an outsider could use to spy upon or disrupt the Orphan's Moon rites. There were about 10 dozen people in the vault. That was a scant fraction of the people in Camor whose lives were supposed to be ruled by the god with the hidden name, but that, according to Chains, was the nature of devotion. It was easy to mutter prayers and curses in the heat of the moment, and less convenient to skulk around in the middle of nowhere on the one night a year the dedicated actually came together.
"This is the temple of the church without temples," said a woman in a hooded grey cloak as she stepped into the middle of the vaulted chamber. "This is the ceremony of the order without ceremonies."
"Father of our fortunes, we consecrate this hall to your purpose, to be joined to your grace and to receive your mysteries."
This was Chains, his voice rich and resonant. He took his place by the woman's side, wearing a similar robe.
"We are thieves among thieves. Our lot is shared. We are keepers of signs and passwords, here without malice or guile."
This is our calling and our craft, which you from love have given us. The third speaker was the garrister who'd sworn the postulants to secrecy, now robed in grey. Father of shadows, who teaches us to take what we would dare to take, receive our devotions.
You have taught us that good fortune may be seized and shared, said the female priest.
Thieves prosper, chanted the crowd. You have taught us the virtue and the necessity of our arts, said Father Chains.
The rich remember.
You have given us the darkness to be our shield, said the third priest, and taught us the blessings of fellowship.
We are thieves among thieves.
Blessed are the quick and the daring, said Chains, moving to the front of the hall, where a block of stone had been covered with a black silk drape. Blessed are the patient and the watchful. Blessed is the one who aids a thief, hides a thief, revenges a thief, and remembers a thief, for they shall inherit the night.
Inherit the night, chanted the crowd solemnly. We are gathered in peace in the eyes of our benefactor, the 13th prince of earth and heaven, whose name is guarded.
The female priest spoke now and took a place by Chain's left hand.
This is the night he claims for his remembrance, the orphan's moon.
Are there any among us who would swear a solemn covenant with this temple and take the oath of joining? Said the third priest.
This was the crucial moment. Any thief, anyone even remotely connected to an unlawful existence, was welcome in this company, so long as they took the oath of secrecy. But those taking the next step, the oath of joining, would proclaim their choice of the unnamed 13th as their heavenly patron. They would certainly not be turning their backs on the other gods of the Therin pantheon, but to their patron they would owe their deepest prayers and best offerings for as long as they lived. Even children studying to become priests didn't take formal oaths of joining until their early teens, and many people never took them at all, preferring to cultivate a loose devotion to all gods rather than a more formal obligation to one. Nazca was the first to step forward, and behind her, in a self-conscious rush, came everyone else. Once the postulants had arranged themselves with as much dignity as they could manage, Chains held up his hands.
This decision, once made, cannot be unmade. The gods are jealous of promises and will not suffer this oath to be cast aside. Be therefore sober and solemnly resolved, or stand aside. There is no shame in not being ready at this time.
None of the postulants backed down. Chains clapped three times, and the sound echoed around the vault.
Hail the crooked warden, said the three priests in unison.
Stop!
A new voice boomed from the back of the chamber, and from behind the crowd of watchers came a trio of men in black robes and masks, followed by a woman in a red dress. They stormed down the aisle in the center of the vault, shoving the postulants aside, and formed a line between them and the altar.
Stop at once!
The speaker was a man whose mask was a stylized bronze sun, with carved rays spreading from a sinister, unsmiling face. He seized Auretta, a scar-covered girl with a reputation as a knife-fighter, and dragged her forward.
The sun commands you now! I burn away shadows, banish night, make your sins plain. Honest men rise as I rise, and sleep as I set. I am lord and father of all propriety. Who are you to defy me?
A thief among thieves, said Auretta.
Take my curse. The night shall be your day, the pale moon's your sun.
I take your curse as a blessing of my heavenly patron, said Auretta.
Does this one speak for you all?
She does,
yelled the crowd of postulants. The sun threw Auretta to the ground, not gently, and turned his back on them all.
Now hear the words of justice, said the woman in the red dress,
which was short and slashed. She wore a velvet mask like those used by the Duke's magistrates to conceal their identities. Justice pulled Nasca forward by her shoulders and forced her to kneel.
All things I weigh, but gold counts dearest, and you have none. All names I read, but those with titles please me best, and you descend from common dirt. Who are you to defy me?
A thief among thieves, said Nasca.
Take my curse. All who serve me shall be vigilant to your faults, blind to your virtues, and deaf to your pleading.
I take your curse as a blessing of my heavenly patron, said Nasca.
Does this one speak for you all?
She does.
Justice flung Nasca into the crowd and turned her back.
I am the hired man, said a man in a brown leather mask.
A shield and truncheon were slung over the back of his robe. He grabbed Jean.
I bar every door. I guard every wall. I wear the leash of better men. I fill the gutters with your blood to earn my bread. Your cries are my music. Who are you to defy me?
A thief among thieves, said Jean.
Take my curse. I shall hound you by sun or stars. I shall use you and incite you to betray your brothers and sisters.
I take your curse as a blessing of my heavenly patron, said Jean.
Do you?
The man shook Jean fiercely.
Does this one speak for you all?
He does.
The hired man released Jean, laughed, and turned his back. Locke nudged several other postulants aside to be the first to help Jean back to his feet.
I am Judgment, said the last of the newcomers, a man whose black mask was without ornament.
He wielded a hangman's noose. With this he caught Tesso Volanti around the neck and yanked him forward. The boy grimaced, clutched at the rope, and fought for balance.
Hear me well. I am Mercy Refused. I am expedience. I am a signature on a piece of parchment. And that is how you die. By clerks, by stamps, by seals in wax. I am cheap. I am easy. I am always hungry. Who are you to defy me?
A thief among thieves, gasped Tesso.
And will they all hang with you for fellowship, and split death into equal shares like loot?
I am not caught yet,
growled the boy.
Take my curse. I shall wait for you.
I take your curse as a blessing of my heavenly patron, said Tesso.
Does this fool speak for you all?
He does.
You were all born to hang.
The man released Tesso from his noose and turned away. Volanti stumbled backward and was caught by Carlo and Galdo.
Depart, phantoms, shouted Chains. Go with empty hands. Tell your masters how slight a dread we bear for thee, and how deep a scorn.
The four costumed antagonists marched back down the aisle, until they vanished from Locke's sight somewhere behind the crowd near the chamber door.
Now, face your oath, said Chains.
The female priest set a leather-bound book on the altar, and the male priest set a metal basin next to it. Chains pointed at Locke. Tense with excitement, Locke stepped up to the altar.
What are you called?
Locke Lamora.
Are you a true and willing servant of our 13th god, whose name is guarded?
I am.
Do you consecrate thought, word, and deed to his service from now until the weighing of your soul?
I do.
Will you seal this oath with blood?
I will seal it with blood on a token of my craft.
Chains handed Locke a ceremonial blade of blackened steel.
What is the token?
A coin of gold, stolen with my own hands, said Locke.
He used the knife to prick his left thumb, then squeezed blood onto the gold tyrin he'd scored from the cake business. He set the coin in the basin and passed the blade back to Chains.
"This is the law of men," said Chains, pointing at the leather-bound tome, "which tells you that you must not steal. What is this law to you?"
"Words on paper," said Locke.
"You renounce and spurn this law?"
"With all my soul."
Locke leaned forward and spat on the book.
"May the shadows know you for their own, brother."
Chains touched a cool, gleaming coin to Locke's forehead.
"I bless you with silver, which is the light of moons and stars."
"I bless you with the dust of cobblestones on which you tread," said the female priest, brushing a streak of grime onto Locke's right cheek.
"I bless you with the waters of Camor, which brings the wealth you hope to steal," said the third priest, touching wet fingers to Locke's left cheek.
And so it was done, the oath of joining, without a fumble or a missed cadence. Warm with pride, Locke rejoined the other boys and girls, though he stood just a few feet apart from them. The ritual continued, Nazca next, then Jean, then Tesso, then Sabatha. There was a general murmur of appreciation when she revealed her offering of stolen truncheons. After that, things went smoothly until one of the Sansas was beckoned forth, and they stepped up to the altar together.
"One at a time, boys," said Chains.
"We're doing it together," said Carlo. "We figured the crooked warden wouldn't want us any other way," said Carlo.
The twins joined hands.
"Well, then," Chains grinned. "It's your problem if he doesn't, lads. What are you called?"
"Carlo Giacomo Petruzzo Sanza. Galdo Castellano Molitani Sanza."
"Are you true and willing servants of our 13th god, whose name is guarded?"
"We are."
"Do you consecrate thought, word, and deed to his service from now until the weighing of your souls?"
"We do."
Once the Sansas were finished, the remaining postulants took their oaths without further complication. Chains addressed the assembly while his fellow priests carried away the offering-filled basin. They would give its contents to the dark waters of the Iron Sea later that night.
"One thing, then, remains. The possibility of a choosing. We priests of the Crooked Warden are few in number, and few are called to join our ranks. Consider carefully whether you would offer yourselves for the third and final oath, the oath of service. Let those who would not desire this join their fellows at the sides of the chamber. Let those who would stand for choosing remain where they are."
The crowd of postulants cleared out rapidly. Some hesitated, but most had looks of perfect contentment on their faces, including Jean and the Sansas. Locke pondered silently. Did he truly want this? Did it feel right? Weren't there supposed to be signs, omens, some sort of guidance, one way or another? Maybe it would be best just to step aside. He suddenly realized that the only person still standing on the floor beside him was Sabatha. There was no hesitation in her manner. Arms folded, chin slightly up, she stood as though ready to physically fight anyone who questioned her feelings. She was staring sideways at Locke, expectantly. Was this the sign? What would she think of him if he turned away from this chance? The thought of failing to match Sabatha's courage while standing right in front of her was like a knife in his guts. He squared his shoulders and nodded at Chains.
"Two bold souls," said Chains quietly. "Kneel and bow your heads in silence. We three shall pray for guidance."
Locke went down to his knees, folded his hands and closed his eyes.
"Crooked warden, don't let me make some sort of awful mistake in front of Sabatha," he thought.
Then he realized that praying on the matter of his own problems at a moment like this might well be blasphemous.
"Shit!"
was his next thought, and that, of course, was even worse. He struggled to keep his mind respectfully blank,
and listened to the murmur of adult voices. Chains and his peers conferred privately for some time. At last Locke heard footsteps approaching.
"One will be chosen," said the female priest, "and must answer directly. The chance, if refused, will never be offered again."
"Small things guide us in this," said the long-haired Garista. "Signs from the past, the evidence of your deeds, subtle omens."
"But the benefactor doesn't make difficult decisions for us," said the woman. "We pray that our choice will serve his interests and thus our own."
"Locke Lamora,"
said Father Chains softly, setting his hands on Locke's shoulders,
"you are called to the service of the 13th Prince of Earth and Heaven, whose name is guarded. How do you answer his call?"
Wide-eyed with shock, Locke glanced at Chains and then at Sabatha.
"I,"
he whispered, then cleared his throat and spoke more clearly.
I must. I do."
Cheers broke out in the vault, but the look on Sabatha's face at that instant cut coldly through Locke's excitement. It was a look he knew only too well, a look he'd practiced himself. The game face, the perfect blank, a neutral mask meant to hide hotter emotions. Given her earlier attitude, Locke had no difficulty guessing what those hotter emotions must be. Chapter 4. Across the Amethel. 1. Everything that was wrong came to a crescendo at once. Locke's screams, Jean's crippling vertigo, and the surging black candle flames, filling the cabin with their ghastly grave-water unlight. There was a bone-rattling vibration in the hot air, a sensation that something vast and unseen was rushing past at high speed. Then the black flames died, casting the room into real darkness. Locke's screams trailed off into hoarse sobs. Jean's strength failed. Pressed down by nausea that felt like a weighted harness, he tumbled forward and his chin hit the deck hard enough to bring back memories of his less successful alley brawls. He resolved to rest for just a handful of heartbeats. Heartbeats became breaths, became minutes. Another of Patience's cohorts pushed the cabin door open at last and came down the steps with a lantern. By that wobbling yellow light, Jean was able to take in the scene. Patience and Cold Marrow were still standing, still conscious, but clutching one another for support. The two younger Bonds Magi were on the floor, though whether alive or dead, Jean couldn't muster the will to care.
"Arkadama,"
said the newcomer with the lantern. Patience brushed the woman off with a shaky wave. Jean rose to one knee, groaning. The nausea was still like 10 hangovers wrapped around a boot to the head, but the thought that Patience was upright stung his pride enough to lend him strength. He blinked, still feeling a prickly inflammation at the edges of his eyes, and coughed. The candelabrum was charred black and wreathed in vile-smelling smoke. The woman with the lantern flung the stern windows open, and blessedly fresh lake air displaced some of the miasma. Another few moments passed, and Jean finally stumbled to his feet. Standing beside Cold Marrow, he clung to the table and shook Locke's left arm. Locke moaned and arched his back, to Jean's immense relief. The ink and dream steel ran off Locke's pale skin in 100 black and silver rivulets, forming a complete mess, but at least he was breathing. Jean noticed that Locke's fingers were curled tightly in against his palms, and he carefully eased them apart.
"Did it work?"
Jean muttered. When neither of the Magi responded, Jean touched Patience on the shoulder.
"Patience, can you—"
"It was close," she said.
She opened her eyes slowly, wincing.
"Stragos Alchemist knew his business."
"But Locke's all right."
"Of course he's not all right."
She extricated herself from the silver thread that bound her to Cold Marrow.
"Look at him. All we can promise is that he's no longer poisoned."
Jean's nausea subsided as the night breeze filled the room. He wiped some of the silvery black detritus from under Locke's chin and felt the fluttering pulse in his neck.
"Jean,"
Locke whispered.
"You look like hell."
"Well, you look like you lost a fight with a drunken ink merchant."
"Jean,"
said Locke, more sharply. He seized Jean's left forearm.
"Jean, gods, this is real! Oh, gods, I thought I saw—"
"Easy now," said Jean. "You're safe."
"I—"
Locke's eyes lost their focus, and his head sank.
"Damnation,"
muttered Patience. She wiped more of the black and silver mess from Locke's face and touched his forehead.
"He's so far gone."
"What's wrong now?" said Jean.
"What you and I just endured," said Patience, "was a fraction of the shock he had to bear. His body is strained to its mortal limits."
"So what do you do about it? More magic?"
"My arts can't heal. He needs nourishment. He needs to be stuffed with food until he can't hold another scrap. We've made arrangements."
Cold Marrow groaned, but nodded and staggered out of the cabin. He returned carrying a tray. This bore a stack of towels, a pitcher of water, and several plates heaped with food. He set the tray on the table just above Locke's head, then cleaned Locke's face and chest with the towels. Jean took a pinch of baked meat from the tray, pulled Locke's chin down, and stuffed it into his mouth.
"Come now," said Jean. "No falling asleep."
"Oomph,"
Locke mumbled. He moved his jaw a few times, started to chew, and opened his eyes once more. He muttered.
"Swallow," said Jean.
"Oomph."
Locke obeyed, then gestured for the water. Jean eased Locke onto his elbows and held the pitcher to his lips. Cold Marrow continued to wipe the ink and dream steel away, but Locke took no notice. He gulped water in undignified slurps until the pitcher was empty.
"More,"
said Locke, turning his attention to the food. The mage with the lantern set it down, took the pitcher, and hurried out. The stuff on the tray was simple fare: baked ham, rough dark bread, some sort of rice with gravy. Locke attacked it as if it were the first food the gods had ever conjured on earth. Jean held a plate for him while Locke pushed the bread around with shaking hands, scooped everything else into his mouth, and barely paused to chew. By the time the water pitcher returned, he was on his second plate.
"Mmm,"
he mumbled, and a number of other monosyllables of limited philosophical utility. His eyes were bright, but they had a dazed look. His awareness seemed to have narrowed to the plate and pitcher. Cold Marrow finished cleaning him off, and Patience stretched a hand out above his legs. The rope that had bound him to the table unknotted itself and leapt into her grasp, coiling itself neatly. The first tray of food, enough to feed 4 or 5 hungry people, was soon gone. When the attending mage brought a second, Locke attacked it without slowing. Patience watched him alertly. Cold Marrow, meanwhile, tended to the young magi who had collapsed during the ritual.
"They alive?"
said Jean, at last finding a residue of courtesy, if nothing more.
"What happened to them?"
"Ever tried to lift a weight that was too heavy?"
Cold Marrow brushed his fingers against the forehead of the unconscious young woman.
"They'll be fine, and wiser for the experience. Young minds are brittle. Oldsters now, we've had some disappointments. We've set aside the notion that we're the center of the universe, so our minds bend with strain instead of meeting it head-on."
Cold Marrow's knees popped as he stood.
"There," he said. "On top of all our other services this evening, some philosophy."
"Jean,"
Locke muttered.
"Jean, where the hell? What am I doing?"
"Trying to fill a hole," said Patience.
"Well, was I? I seem to have lost myself just now. I feel God's damned strange."
Jean put a hand on Locke's shoulder and frowned.
"You're getting warmer,"
he said. He set his palm against Locke's forehead and felt a fever heat.
"Certainly doesn't feel like it on my side of things,"
said Locke. Shivering, he reached for the blanket on his legs. Jean grabbed it for him and draped it across his shoulders.
"You back to your senses, then?" asked Jean.
"Am I? You tell me. I've never felt so hungry. Ever. Hell, I'd still be eating, but I think I'm out of room. I don't know what came over me."
"It will come over you again," said Patience.
"Oh, lovely. Well, this may be a stupid question," said Locke, "but did it work?"
"If it hadn't, you'd have died 20 minutes ago," said Patience.
"So it's out of me," muttered Locke, staring down at his hands. "Gods, what a mess. I feel, I don't know, other than the 100 tons I just shoved into my stomach, I can't tell if I'm actually feeling any better."
"Well, I'm sure as hell feeling better," said Jean.
"I'm cold. Hands and feet are numb. Feels like I've aged 100 years.
Locke slid off the table, drawing the blanket more tightly around himself.
"I think I can stand up, though."
He demonstrated the questionable optimism of this pronouncement by falling on his face.
"Damn," he muttered as Jean picked him up. "Sure you can't do anything about this, Patience?"
"Master Lamora, you full-blooded ingrate, haven't I worked enough miracles on your behalf for one night?"
"Purely as a business investment," said Locke. "But I suppose I should thank you nonetheless."
"Yes, nonetheless. As for your strength, everything now falls to nature. You need food and rest, like any other convalescent."
"Well," said Locke, "if it's no trouble, I'd like to speak alone with Jean.
Shall I have the cabin cleared?"
"No."
Locke stared at the unconscious young magi for a moment.
"No, let your apprentices or whatever sleep off their hangovers. A walk on deck will do me some good."
"They do have names," said Patience. "You'll be working for us. You might as well accept that. They're called..."
"Stop," said Locke. "I'm bloody grateful for what you've done here, but you're not hauling me to Carthane to be anyone's friend. Forgive me if I don't feel cordial."
"I suppose I should take your restoration to boorishness as a credit to my arts," said Patience with a sigh. "I'll give instructions to have more food and water set out for you."
"I doubt I could eat another bite," said Locke.
"Oh, wait a few minutes," said Patience. "I've been with child. Rely on my assurance that you'll be ruled by your belly for some time to come."
2.
"I tell you, Jean, he was there. He was there looking down at me, closer than you are right now."
Locke and Jean leaned against the Sky Reacher's taffrail, watching the soft play of the ghost lights that gave the Lake of Jewels its name. They gleamed in the black depths, specks of cold ruby fire and soft diamond white, like submerged stars far out of human reach. Their nature was unknown. Some said they were the souls of the 1,000 mutineers drowned by the mad Emperor Oryxanos. Others swore they must be Eldrin treasures. In Lachine, Jean had even read a pamphlet in which a Therin Collegium scholar argued that the lights were glowing fish, imbued with the alchemical traces that had spilled into the lake in the decades since the perfection of light globes. Whatever they were a pretty enough distraction, rippling faintly beneath the ship's wake. Smears of grey at the horizon hinted the approach of dawn, but a low ceiling of dark clouds still occluded the sky. Locke was shaky and feverish, wearing his blanket like a shawl. In between sentences, he munched nervously at a piece of dried ship's biscuit from the small pile he carried wrapped in a towel.
"Given what was happening to you, Locke, I think the safest bet by far would be that you imagined it."
"He spoke to me in his own voice," said Locke, shuddering.
Jean gave him a friendly squeeze on the shoulder, but Locke went on.
"And his eyes! His eyes! Did you ever hear anything like that at the temples you entered? About a person's sins being engraved on their eyes?"
"No," said Jean. "But then you'd know more inner ritual of at least one temple than I would. Is it treading on any of your vows to ask if you..."
"No, no," said Locke. "It's nothing I ever learned in the Order of the 13th.
"Then you did imagine the whole mess."
"Why the hell would I imagine something like that?"
"Because you're a god's damned guilt-obsessed idiot?
Easy for you to be glib."
"I'm not. Look, do you really think the life beyond life is such a farce that people wander around in spirit with their bodies mutilated? You think souls have two eyes in their heads, or need them?
We see certain truths manifested in limited forms for our own apprehension," said Locke. "We don't see the life after life as it truly is, because in our eyes it conforms to our mechanics of nature."
"Straight out of elementary theology, just as I learned it several times," said Jean. "Anyway, since when are you a connoisseur of revelation? Have you ever, at any point in your life since you became a priest, been struck by the light of heavenly clarity, by dreams and visions, by omens, or anything that made you quake in your breeches and say, 'Holy shit, the gods have spoken!'"
"You know I would have told you if I had," said Locke. "Besides, that's not how things work, not as we're taught in our order."
"You think any sect isn't told the exact same thing, Locke? Or do you honestly believe that there's a temple of divines out there somewhere constantly getting thumped on the head by bolts of white-hot truth, while the rest of you are left to stumble around on intuition?"
"Broadening the discussion, aren't you?"
"Not at all. After so many years, so many scrapes, so much blood, why would you suddenly start having true revelations from beyond the grave now?"
"I can't know. I can't presume to speak for the gods."
"But that's precisely what you're doing. Listen, if you walk into a whorehouse and find yourself getting sucked off, it's because you put some money on the counter, not because the gods transported a pair of lips to your cock."
"That's a really incredible metaphor, Jean, but I think I could use some help translating it."
"What I'm saying is, we have a duty to accept on faith, but also a duty to weigh and judge. Once you insist that some mundane thing was actually the miraculous hand of the gods, why not treat everything that way? When you start finding messages from the heavens in your breakfast sausages, you've thrown aside your responsibility to use your head. If the gods wanted credulous idiots for priests, why wouldn't they make you that way when you were chosen?"
"This didn't happen while I was eating breakfast, for fuck's sake."
"Yeah, it happened while you were this far from death."
Jean held up his thumb and forefinger, squeezed tightly together.
"Sick, exhausted, drugged, and under the tender care of our favorite people in the world. I'd find it strange if you didn't have a nightmare or two."
"It was so vivid, though, and he was so..."
"You said he was cold and vengeful. Does that sound like Bug? And do you really think he'd still be there, wherever you imagined him, hovering around years after he died, just to frighten you for half a minute?"
Locke stuffed more biscuit into his mouth and chewed agitatedly.
"I refuse to believe," said Jean, "that we live in a world where the Lady of the Long Silence would let a boy's spirit wander unquiet for years in order to scare someone else. Bug's long gone, Locke. It was just a nightmare."
"I sure as hell hope so," said Locke.
"Worry about something else," said Jean. "I mean it now. The Magi came through on their end of our deal. We'll be expected to make ourselves useful next."
"Some convalescence," said Locke.
"I am glad as hell to see you up and moping on your own two feet again. I need you, brother. Not lying in bed useless as a piece of pickled dog shit."
"I'm going to remember all of this tender sympathy next time you're ill," said Locke.
"I tenderly and sympathetically didn't heave you off a cliff."
"Fair enough," said Locke.
He turned around and glanced across the lantern-lit reaches of the deck.
"You know, I think my wits might be less congealed. I've just noticed that there's nobody in charge of this ship."
Jean glanced around. None of the Magi were visible anywhere else on deck. The ship's wheel was still, as though restrained by ghostly pressure.
"Gods," said Jean, "who the hell's doing that?"
"I am,"
said Patience, appearing at their side. She held a steaming mug of tea and gazed out across the jewel-dotted depths.
"Gah!" Locke slid away from her. "My nerves are scraped raw. Must you do that?"
Patience sipped her tea with an air of satisfaction.
"Have it your way," said Locke. "What happened to all of your little acolytes?"
"Everyone's shaken from the ritual. I've sent them down for some rest."
"You're not shaken?"
"Nearly to pieces," she said.
"Yet you're moving this ship against the wind, alone, while talking to us."
"I am. Nonetheless, I'd wager that you're still going to misplace your tone of respect whenever you speak to me."
"Lady, you knew I was poison when you picked me up," said Locke.
And how are you now?
Tired. Damned tired. Feels like someone poured sand in my joints. But there's nothing eating at my insides. Not like before. I'm hungry as all hell, but it's not evil. Not anymore.
And your wits?
They'll serve, said Locke. Besides, Jean's here to catch me when I fall.
I've had the great cabin cleaned for you. There's a wardrobe with a set of slops. They'll keep you warm until we reach Carthane and throw you to the tailors.
We can't wait, said Locke. Patience, are we in any danger of running aground or something if we ask you a few questions?
There's nothing to run aground on for 100 miles yet. But are you sure you don't want to rest?
I'll collapse soon enough. I can feel it. I don't want to waste another lucid moment if I can help it, said Locke. You remember what you promised us in Lachaine? Answers, I mean.
Of course, she said, so long as you recall the limitation I set.
I'll try not to get too personal.
Good, said Patience. Then I'll try not to waste a great deal of effort by setting you on fire if my temper runs short.
3. Why do you people serve? Said Locke. Why take contracts? Why bonds, Magi?
Why work on a fishing boat?
Patience breathed the steam from her tea.
Why stomp grapes into wine? Why steal from gullible nobles?
You need money that badly?
As a tool, certainly. Its application is simple and universally effective.
And that's it? Isn't that good enough for your own life?
It just seems... It seems, said Patience, that what you really want to ask is why we care about money at all when we could take anything we please.
Yes, said Locke.
What makes you think we would behave like that?
Despite your sudden interest in my welfare, you're scheming skull-fucking bastards, said Locke. And your consciences are shriveled like an old man's balls. Start with Therim Pell. You did burn an entire city off the map.
Any few hundred people sufficiently motivated could have destroyed Therim Pell. Sorcery wasn't the only means that would have sufficed.
Easy for you to say, said Locke. Let's allow that maybe all you theoretically needed were some gardening tools and a little creativity. What you actually did was rain fire from the fucking sky. If your lot couldn't rule the world with that...
Are you smarter than a pig, Locke?
On occasion, said Locke. There are contrary opinions.
Are you more dangerous than a cow, a chicken, a sheep?
Let's be generous and say yes.
Then why don't you go to the nearest farm, put a crown on your head, and proclaim yourself emperor of the animals?
Because...
The thought of doing anything so ridiculous never crossed your mind?
I suppose.
Yet you wouldn't deny that you have the power to do it any time you like, with no chance of meaningful resistance from your new subjects.
Still not an attractive proposition, is it? Said Patience. So that's really it, said Jean. Any half-witted bandit living on bird shit in the hinterlands would make himself emperor if he could, but you people who actually can do it at will are such paragons of reason.
Why sit in a farmyard with a crown on your head when you can buy all the ham you like down at the market?
You've banished ambition completely, said Jean.
We're ambitious to the bone, Jean. Our training doesn't give the meek room to breathe. However, most of us find it starkly ludicrous that the height of all possible ambition to the ungifted must be to drape oneself in crowns and robes.
Most, said Locke.
Most, said Patience. I did mention that we've had a schism over the years. You might not be surprised to hear that it concerns you.
She crooked two fingers on her left hand at Locke and Jean.
The ungifted. What to do with you? Keep to ourselves or put the world on its knees? Nobility would no longer be a matter of patents and lineages. It would be a self-evident question of sorcerer's skill. You would be enslaved without restraint to a power you could never possess, not with all the time or money or learning in the world. Would you like to live in such an empire?
Of course not, said Locke.
Well, I have no desire to build it. Our arts have given us perfect independence. Our wealth has made that freedom luxurious. Most of us recognize this.
You keep using that word, said Locke. Most.
There are exceptionalists within our ranks, mages that look upon your kind as ready-made abjects. They've always been a minority, held firmly in check by those of us with a more conservative and practical philosophy, but they have never been so few as to be laughed off. These are the two factions I spoke of earlier. The exceptionalists tend to be young, gifted, and aggressive. My son was popular with them before you crossed his path in Camor.
Great, said Locke. So those assholes that came and paid us a visit in Tal Verar on your sufferance don't even have to leave the comforts of home for another go at us. Brilliant!
I gave them that outlet to leaven their frustration, said Patience. If I had commanded absolute safety for you, they would have disobeyed and murdered you. After that, I would have had no answer to their insubordination short of civil war. The peace of my society balances at all times on points like this. You two are just the most recent splinter under everyone's nails.
What will your insubordinate friends do when we get to Carthane? Give us hugs, buy us beer, pat us on our heads, said Jean.
They won't trouble you, said Patience. You're part of the five-year game now, protected by its rules. If they harm you outright, they call down harsh retribution. However, if their chosen agents outmaneuver you, then they steal a significant amount of prestige from my faction. They need you to be pieces on the board as much as I do.
What if we win? Said Jean. What will they do afterward?
If you do manage to win, you can naturally expect the goodwill of myself and my friends to shelter under.
So we're working for the kind-hearted, moral side of your little guild. Is that what we should understand? Said Locke.
Kind-hearted? Don't be ridiculous, said Patience. But you're a fool if you can't believe that we've spent a great deal of time reflecting on the moral questions of our unique position. The fact that you're even here, alive and well, testifies to that reflection.
And yet you hire yourselves out to overthrow kingdoms and kill people.
We do, said Patience. Human beings are afflicted with short memories. They need to be reminded that they have valid reasons for holding us in awe. That's why, after very careful consideration, we still allow Magi to accept black contracts.
Define careful consideration, said Locke.
Any request for services involving death or kidnapping is scrutinized, said Patience. Black work needs to be authorized by a majority of my peers. Even once that's done, there needs to be at least one mage willing to accept the task. Patience cupped her left hand, and a silver light flashed behind her fingers. You curious men, she said. I offer you the answers to damn near anything, secrets thousands of people have died trying to uncover, and you want to learn how we go about paying our bills.
We're not done pestering you, said Locke. What are you doing there?
Remembering.
The silver glow faded, and a slender spike of dream steel appeared, cradled against the first two fingers of her hand.
You're bold enough in your questions. Are you bold enough for a direct answer?
What's the proposal? Said Locke, nibbling half-consciously at a biscuit.
Walk in my memories. See through my eyes. I'll show you something relevant, if you've got the strength to handle it.
Locke swallowed in a hurry.
Is this going to be as much fun as the last ritual?
Magic's not for the timid. I won't offer again.
What do I do?
Lean forward.
Locke did so, and Patience held the silver spike toward his face. It narrowed, twisted, and poured itself through the air, directly into Locke's left eye. He gasped. The biscuits tumbled from his hand as the dream steel spread in a pool across his eye, turning it into a rippling mirror. A moment later, droplets of silver appeared in his right eye, thickening and spreading.
What the hell?
Jean was torn between the urge to slap Patience aside and the sternness of her earlier warning not to interfere with her sorcery.
Jean, wait! Whispered Locke.
He stood transfixed, tied to Patience's hand by a silver strand, his eyes gleaming. The trance lasted perhaps 15 seconds, and then the dream steel withdrew. Locke wobbled and clutched the taffrail, blinking furiously.
Holy hells!
he said. "What a sensation!"
"What happened?" said Jean.
"She was... I don't know exactly, but I think you'll want to see this."
Patience turned to Jean, extending the hand with the silver needle. Jean leaned forward and fought to avoid flinching as the narrow silver point came toward him. It brushed his open eye like a breath of cold air, and the world around him changed. 4. Footsteps echoing on marble. Faint murmur of conversation in an unknown language. No, not a murmur, not a noise at all. A soft tickle of thoughts from a dozen strangers brushing against an awareness that Jean hadn't previously known he'd possessed. A flutter like moth wings against the front of his mind. The sensation is frightening. He tries to halt, is startled to discover that the vaporous mass of his body refuses his commands.
"Ah, but these aren't your memories," the voice of Patience inside his head. "You're a passenger. Try to relax, and it will grow easier soon enough." "I don't weigh anything,"
Jean says. The words come from his lips like the weakest half-exhalation of a man with dead stones for lungs. Squeezing them out takes every ounce of will he can muster.
"It's my body you're wearing. I'm leaving some things hazy for your peace of mind. You're here for a study in culture, not anatomy."
Warm light on his face, falling from above. His thoughts are buoyed from below by a sensation of power, a cloud of ghostly whispers he can't seem to grab a meaningful hold of. He rides atop these like a boat bobbing on a deep ocean.
"My mind, my deeper memories, which are quite irrelevant, thank you. Concentrate. I'll make you privy to my strongest, most deliberate thoughts from the moments I'm revealing."
Jean tries to relax, tries to open himself to this experience, and the impressions tumble in, piece by piece, faster and faster. He is struck by a disorienting jumble of information, names, places, descriptions, and, threaded through it all, the thoughts and sigils of many other magi.
"Issa scholastica, Isle of Scholars."
"Akadama, it's not like you to keep us waiting."
"Private citadel of the Magi of Carthane."
"Is it because..."
"Feeling of resigned annoyance."
"Falconer."
"Damn that obvious and inevitable question."
"Sound of footsteps on smooth marble."
"Can well understand."
"His presence has nothing to do with my tardiness." "Would feel the same in your place. As if I'd hide from my duties because of him."
"Gods above, did I earn 5 rings by being meek?"
There is a plain wooden door before Jean, the door to the Sky Chamber, the seat of what passes for government among the Magi of Carthane. The door will not open by touch. Anyone attempting to turn the handle will stand dumbfounded as their hand fails again and again to find it, plainly visible though it is. Jean feels a flutter of power as he, Patience, sends her sigil against the door. At this invisible caress, the door falls open.
"Pardon, did not mean to offend."
"The warm air of the Sky Chamber, already packed with..."
"I will not take the wall to my own son." "No need to get annoyed, I was merely..."
"There he sits, waiting."
"Watching, watching, like his damned bird."
The Sky Chamber is a vault of illusion that would make the artificers of Tal Verar weak-kneed with envy. It is the first object of freestanding, honest-to-the-god sorcery that Jean has ever seen. The room is circular, 50 yards in diameter, and Jean knows from Patience's penumbra of knowledge that the domed ceiling is actually 20 feet beneath the ground. Nonetheless, across the great glass sweep of that dome is a counterfeit sky, like a painting brought to life, perfect in every detail. It shows a stately early evening, with the sun hidden away behind gold-rimmed clouds. The Magi await Patience in high-backed chairs, arranged in rising tiers like the Congress of Lords from the Old Empire, a congress long since banished to ashes by the men and women who emulate them. They wear identical hooded robes, a soft dark red the color of roses in shadow. This is their ceremonial dress. Gray or brown robes might have been more neutral, more restful, but the progenitors of the order didn't want their inheritors to grow too restful in their deliberations. One man sits in the foremost rank of chairs, directly across from Jean, Patience, as the door slides shut behind him, her. Perched on one robed arm, statue still, is a hawk that Jean recognizes instantly. He has looked directly into its cold, deadly eyes before, as well as those of its master.
Watching, watching, like his damned bird.
A bombardment of questions and greetings and sigils comes on like a crashing wave, then steadily fades. Order is called for, and relative silence descends, a relief to Jean. And then,
Mother.
The greeting comes a moment too late to be polite. It is sharp and clear as only the thoughts of a blood relative can be. Behind it is an emotional grace note, artfully subdued, the wide, bright sky, a sensation of soaring, a feeling of wind against the face, the absolute freedom of high flight. The sigil of the falconer.
Speaker, she, Jean, replies.
Must we be such prisoners of formality, mother?
This is a formal occasion.
Surely we're alone in our thoughts.
You and I are never alone.
And yet we're never together. How is it we can both mean the exact same thing by those statements?
Don't wax clever with me, speaker. Now isn't the time for your games.
This is as much your game as it is mine.
I will not be interrupted.
There is strength behind that last thought, a pulse of mental muscle the younger mage cannot yet match. A vulgar way to punctuate a conversation, but the falconer takes the point. He bows his head a fraction of a degree, and Vestris, his scorpion hawk, does the same. At the center of the sky chamber is a reflecting pool of dream steel, its surface a perfect, unrippled mirror. Four chairs surround it, three are occupied. The magi have little care for the ungifted custom of setting the highest ranked to gaze upon their inferiors. When so much business is transacted in thought, physical directions begin to lose even symbolic meaning. Jean, Patience, takes the open seat and reaches out to the other three arch-magi. It's as easy as joining flesh-and-blood hands. Arcadons and Arcadamas pool energies, crafting a joined sigil, an ideogram that fills the room for an instant with the thought shape of four names. Patience, Providence, Foresight, Temperance. The names are meaningless, traditional, having nothing to do with the personal qualities of their holders. The fused sigil proclaims the commencement of formal business. The light in the chamber dims in response. The early evening sky is replaced by a bowl of pre-dawn violet with a warm line of tawny gold at the horizon. Archidon Temperance, senior most of the four, sends forth.
We return to the matter of the black contract proposed by Luciano Anatolius of Camor.
There is a twist, a wrench in Jean's perceptions. Patience, the here-and-now Patience, adjusts her memories, shifts them to a context he can better understand. The thought voices of the magi take on the quality of speech.
We remain divided on whether or not the consequences of this proposal exceed the allowances of our guiding mandates. First, the question of self-harm. Second, the question of common detriment.
Temperance is a lean man of 70, with brown skin the texture of wind-whipped tree bark. His hair is grey, and his clouding eyes are milky agates in deep, dark sockets. Yet his mind remains vigorous. He has worn 5 rings for half his life.
With respect, Archidon, I would call on the Assembly to also consider the question of higher morality.
This from a pale woman in the first row of seats. Her left arm is missing, and a fold of robe hangs pinned at that shoulder like a mantle. She stands, and with her other hand sweeps her hood back, revealing thin blonde hair woven tightly under a silver mesh cap. This gesture is the privilege of a speaker, announcing her intention to take the floor and attempt to influence the current discussion. Jean knows this woman from Patience's subtle whispers. Navigator, three rings, born on a Vadran trading ship and brought to Carthain as a child. Her private obsession is the study of the sea, and she is closely identified with Patience's allies.
Speaker, says Jean, Patience, you know full well that no proposed contract need to be proven against anything broader than our own mandates.
Patience gets this out quickly, to create an impression of neutrality that is not entirely honest, and to stress the obvious before someone with a more belligerent outlook can seize the chance to make a fiercer denunciation.
Of course, says Navigator, I have no desire to challenge the law provided by our founders in all their formidable sagacity. I am not suggesting that we test the proposed contract on my terms, but that we have an obligation to test ourselves.
Speaker, the distinction is meaningless.
Foresight speaks now, youngest of the Archmagi, barely 40. She and the Falconer are associates. She is also the most aggressive of the five-ring Magi, her will as hard as elderglass.
We are divided on questions of clear and binding law. Why do you muddle this deliberation with nebulous philosophy?
The point is hardly nebulous, Arkadama. It bears directly upon the first mandate, the question of self-harm. The sheer scope of the slaughter this Anatolius proposes risks some diminishment of ourselves if we agree to it. We are discussing the single greatest bloodbath in the history of our black contracts.
Speaker, you exaggerate, says Foresight. Anatolius has been clear concerning his plans for the nobility of Camor. Few, if any, would actually be killed.
Candidly, Arkadama, you surprise me with your dissembling. Surely we are not such children as to delude ourselves that someone reduced to the state of a living garden decoration by wraithstone poisoning has not, by any practical measure, been murdered.
There is a brightening in the artificial sky as the sun peaks above the horizon. Regardless of the justice of Navigator's argument, the Assembly approves of the manner in which she's making it. The ceiling responds to the mental prodding of the Magi in attendance. The sun literally shines on those that capture general approval, and visibly sets on those that stumble in their arguments.
Sister Speaker, says the Falconer, rising calmly and pushing his own hood back.
Jean feels another chill at the uncovering of his familiar features, the receding hairline, the bright, dangerous eyes and easy air of command.
You've never been coy about the fact that you oppose black contracts on general principle, have you?
Jean draws knowledge from Patience's whispers. There are about half a dozen speakers at any time, popular and forthright magi chosen by secret ballots. They have no power to make or contravene laws, but they do have the right to intrude on Sky Chamber discussions and indirectly represent the interests of their supporters.
Brother Speaker, I'm not aware of having been coy about anything.
What, then, is the full compass of your objection? Is it all higher morality?
Wouldn't that be sufficient? Isn't the question of whether we might be found wanting at the weighing of our souls an adequate basis for restraint?
Is it your only basis?
No. I also put forth the question of our dignity. How can we not do it an injury when we reduce ourselves to paid assassins for the ungifted?
Is that not the very credo by which we work? In cipa vela armatos dei, we become instruments, says the Falconer. To serve the client's design, we make ourselves tools. Sometimes that makes us weapons of murder.
Indeed, a murder weapon is a tool, but not all tools are murder weapons.
When our prospective clients want us to find lost relatives or summon rain, do we not take the contracts? Such is the condition of the world, however, that they tend to want our assistance in matters which are regrettably more sanguine.
We are not helpless in the choosing of the contracts proposed to—
Sister Speaker, your pardon. I interrupt because I fear that we are prolonging this discussion unnecessarily. Allow me to lay your points to rest, so that we may return to cutting our previous knot. You say it's the scope of this particular contract that earns your strenuous objection. How do you suggest that we scale it down to a more agreeably moral operation?
Scale it down?
The whole enterprise is so bloodthirsty and reckless that I can hardly conceive of how we might mitigate it by sparing a few victims among the crowd.
How many would we have to spare for such mitigation as would please you?
You know as well as I, Brother Speaker, that this is not a question of simple arithmetic.
Isn't it? You've listened to proposals for many black contracts over the years. Contracts involving the removal of individuals, gangs, even families. You might have objected in principle, but you never made any attempt to have them disallowed.
A contract for a single murder, while an undignified thing in itself, is at least more precise than the wholesale destruction of an entire city-state's rulers.
I see. Can we agree, then, on a point at which precise becomes wholesale? How many removals tip the balance? Are 15 corpses moral, but 16 excessive? Or 17? Or 29? Surely we must be able to compromise. The low triple digits, perhaps?
You are deliberately reducing my argument past the point of absurdity.
Wrong, Sister Speaker. I take your points very seriously. They have been treated seriously in our laws and customs for centuries, and they have been treated thus in Cipa Vela Armatos Dei. We become instruments. Instruments do not judge.
The falconer spreads his arms. Vestris flaps her wings, hops to his left shoulder, and settles back into comfortable stillness.
That has been our way for centuries, precisely because of situations like this. Precisely because we are not gods, and we are not wise enough to sift the worthy from the unworthy before we take action on behalf of our clients.
Jean has to admire the falconer's cheek, appealing to humility in defense of an argument that Magi should be free to slaughter without remorse.
It is madness to try, continues the falconer. It leads to sophistry and self-righteousness. Our founders were correct to leave us so few mandates by which to weigh the proposals we receive. Will we harm ourselves? This we can answer. Will we harm the wider world to the point that our interests may be damaged? This we can answer. But are the men and women we might remove penitent before the gods? Are they good parents to their children? Are they sweet-tempered? Do they give alms to beggars? And if so, does this compel us to stay our hands? How can we possibly begin to answer such questions? We make ourselves instruments. Anyone we kill as instruments, we deliver to a judgment infinitely wiser than our own. If the removal be a sin, it weighs upon the client who commands it, not those who act under the bond of obedience.
Well put, Speaker.
Archidama Foresight is unable to suppress a smile. The sun has risen while the falconer has made his arguments, and the chamber is flush with a soft golden glow.
I call to my fellow Archmagi for binding. We have no time for the diversion of philosophy. The subject of a specific contract divided us this morning. It divides us now. One way or another, we should end that division, working firmly within the context of the law.
Agreed, says Temperance. Binding.
Reluctantly agreed, says Providence. Binding.
Jean Patience feels a warm glow of gratitude. Providence has bent a point of etiquette, speaking his judgment before that of the more senior Patience, but in so doing he has confirmed the verdict, 3 out of 4. Patience, whatever her actual thoughts on the subject, is now free to conceal them and do a small kindness to Navigator.
Abstain,
Jean Patience says.
Binding,
says Foresight.
Bound, then, says Temperance. All further discussion outside the mandates is set aside.
Navigator pulls her hood up, bows, and sits. The assembly is restored to its previous stalemate. Providence has refused to sanction the proposed contract, while Foresight has endorsed it. Temperance and Patience have yet to express their opinions.
You have more for us, Speaker?
Temperance directs his question at the falconer, who remains standing.
I do, says the young man. If I don't strain your patience in continuing.
Jean is struck by the ambiguity of his insight into this affair. Is it possible to make puns in thought speech? Was that the falconer's design? or is Patience, in translation, highlighting nuances her son didn't intend? Whatever the truth, none of the Archmagi take exception.
I bear no particular love for the people of Camor. Neither do I bear them any particular ill will, says the falconer. The proposed contract is drastic, yes. It will require deftness and discretion, and the removal of many people. It will have consequences, but I would argue that none of them are relevant to us. Let us look to the first mandate, the question of self-harm. Do we have any particular attachment to the current rulers of Camor? No. Do we have any properties or investments in the city we can't protect? No. Do we invite trouble for Carthane by causing upheaval 2,000 miles away? Please, as if our presence here couldn't protect the interests of Carthane even were Camor 2 miles down the road.
You talk of investments. Archidon Providence speaks now, a disarmingly mild man about Patience's age, a staunch ally of hers.
Anatolius casts a wide net with this scheme. Any feast at Raven's Reach will command the presence of the city's money, including Maraggio himself. We do maintain accounts at his house and others. I've researched them, says the falconer. But do these people run counting houses or trade syndicates by themselves? Any one of them will have family, advisers, lieutenants, capable and ambitious inheritors. The money in the vaults won't go anywhere.